Hello, and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned dogs can tell time with their noses. Dog researcher and author Alexandra Horowitz has a new book out called Being a Dog. She shared some of her findings about the incredible olfactory abilities of dogs with Terry Gross on Fresh Air.
I think this is one of the more intriguing things about imagining the olfactory world to a creature like a dog.
You see, a dog's nose is fantastically complex. They have what Horowitz calls stereo olfaction, which means their nostrils work independently of each other. When they get up close, they can actually get a different odor sample from each nostril. They also have hundreds and millions of receptor cells in their nose, and these grab hold of an odor and transmit that information up to their brains. We have them too, but dogs have so many more. And not just more, but different types of receptors that allow them to smell different types of things that would otherwise go undetected in our noses. Just as an example, dogs are trained to sniff out all sorts of things now, from bed bugs and cancer cells to explosives. An explosive detection dog can smell a trillionth of a gram of an explosive. That's basically like the trace of a thing. So that's obviously an extreme example due to the dog's training, but it helps illustrate why smell is the primary way in which dogs engage with the world. But we humans are visual. That's how we interact with the world. So the question that kind of boggles the mind is, how does a day smell? Here's Alexandra Horowitz explaining on Fresh Air.
Well, smells in a room change as the day goes on. Hot air rises, and it usually rises in currents along the walls and will rise to the ceiling and go kind of to the center of the room and drop. And so if we were able to visualize the movement of air through the day, what we're really visualizing is the movement of odor.
Horowitz also says that the concentration of smell can give clues to the day. So a stronger odor is probably a newer one, and a weaker stench is an older one. So with his nose, your dog can probably assess who has been in a place and about what time. This week I learned a sense of humor can actually help you live longer. The Scientific American has this fascinating write-up of a new study out of Norway. Researchers wanted to see how a person's sense of humor connected to their health and longevity. But first you have to understand that humor is a really complex concept. It's not just straight jokes. Humor is made up of three components: cognitive, social, and affective. Now, cognitive is basically the ability to detect humor, to get the intention, like, do you get the joke? The affective element is being able to genuinely enjoy the joke. The social element is how humor plays or is perceived in social situations. Is it taken negatively or positively? Researchers followed a massive amount of men and women, more than 50,000 of them, for a 15-year period. At the end of that time, researchers checked back in with their cohort to see, well, how everyone died, looking at specific conditions like heart disease, infection, cancer, and other such things. According to their findings, funny women made out the best. Women who scored high on the cognitive component had a 50% less risk of death from all causes across the board. But those chances of death got lower when you got more specific. When it came to heart disease, 73% lower risk of death and 83% lower risk of death from infection. Men, unfortunately, didn't make out as well as the ladies, but scoring high in the cognitive component of humor did save men from death by infection, with a 74% reduced risk of death there. When it came to the other components of humor, social and affective, well, they had no influence on your longevity. So what is it about getting the joke that is so life-expanding? Well, the cognitive component is a fairly stable aspect of a personality. Researchers suggest this may help act as a buffer against conflict in social situations and overall stress. This helps stymie the release of stress hormones like cortisol, and over time, chronically elevated levels of cortisol can suppress immune function. But if you're panicking at your overall humorless nature and thinking it means a certain death, fear not. Humor is not just genetic. It is absolutely social as well and can be developed through friendships and other social bonds in childhood and beyond. If that doesn't help, well, try embracing the absurdist humor of life so that you might enjoy it a little bit longer. This week I learned a quick way to ease the sense of regret. Have a cold beverage. I'm not talking about that boozy kind we're not going to drink our discomfort away. This is just a simple cold glass of water. Or iced tea. Actually, it doesn't even matter what's in the glass, it's just about the temperature, according to the findings of a new study out of Western University in Canada. Researchers wanted to examine the link between temperature and emotions, so they looked specifically at regret. In one study, they asked participants to remember a situation where they regretted something they had done, like sending an angry text. This is called action regret. Another group was asked to recall a time they regretted not doing something, like learning a second language. This is called inaction regret. Then each group was presented with an array of warm and cold drinks like hot chocolate, coffee, iced lattes, etc. The people in the active regret group were more likely to choose the colder drinks. And that's because active regret causes a whole domino effect of emotions and physiological responses in the body. If you regret your actions, you feel shame, embarrassment, guilt, and remorse, and those emotions can make you blush and raise your body temperature. So the cold drink literally cools the body and can help calm those associated feelings of shame and embarrassment. Researchers take the theory a step further and suggest that if you are in a warm environment and you do something you regret, you may feel worse about it than if you were in a cold environment. And finally, this week I learned why the pineapple is a symbol of hospitality. Christopher Columbus was the first to bring the tropical fruit back to the European continent after discovering it in the Caribbean in the 1490s. People went wild for its natural sweetness. This was a time when sugar was really hard to come by, so they wanted more. The trouble was, getting a whole pineapple safely from the Caribbean to Europe required the fastest ships, the most competent crews, and the most favorable weather conditions, which basically meant it was near impossible and terribly expensive. Only royalty or the ridiculously wealthy could afford such a luxury. To own a pineapple or to even carry one around was the 17th century equivalent of some serious bling. In England, a pineapple rental market actually emerged to meet demand. If you had a fancy event to attend, you could rent a pineapple for just a few hours. Most of the time, the pineapples were just for show. People didn't even eat it. Often the pineapple would sit as the centerpiece on a dining table or be passed from renter to renter. Soon the pineapple's image was elevated to the same status of wealth and hospitality. Artists depicted the fruit on napkins, tablecloths, wallpaper, and even bedposts, so that even if you couldn't afford a real one, you could gaze at its spiky image on your teapot. The practice spread over to colonial America. Ship captains returning to the mainland after a long journey would place a pineapple outside their home as a sign that they were in town and ready to receive visitors. Finally, in the 1900s, the founder of what would become the Dole Food Company started a pineapple plantation in Hawaii, and over time helped democratize the fruit, making it an accessible treat for the masses. And just a note, I came across this fun fruity fact in the pages of the November-December issue of Mental Floss magazine. This one is all about big questions, and it is unfortunately the magazine's farewell issue. They'll move on from print and focus all their fun, fact-driven attention to the wide digital world. But if you want to feel smart again, I urge you to pick up a copy for yourself. And that does it for this week's episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. To read more about any of the facts I've mentioned or to check out any of the week's podcasts, including 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainers, go to theweek.com/podcasts. And if you like what you hear, subscribe, tell your friends, or give us a rating or review on iTunes. I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.